Hey Tim.
Hey Matt, how's it going?
Doing well, doing well. A lot of exciting stuff happening out there today.
It's been a
Thanks
very
for
busy
filling.
week.
Indeed, thanks for filling in for Bill, who once again is on assignment.
Well, so it's a pleasure. His loss is my gain.
Well, so much to talk about, but one of the things that's very interesting are the continuing retirements of Democrat House members. Right now, we're up to four more of. Kansas 3, Tanner, Tennessee 8, Baird, Washington 3, Gordon, Tennessee 6. And the NRCC put out a memo today basically implying that Democrats are seeing the writing on the wall. And the DCCC, interesting, Jim Gary over at National Review, noted that the DCCC put out an I'm not retiring list. But of note, is that there were some people not who weren't on that list. There were some Democrats who weren't on that list, including Rick Boucher of Virginia, John Spratt of South Carolina, Leonard Boswell of Iowa, Barron Hill, Indiana, Vic Snyder, Arkansas, Alan Boyd, Florida, Mike Ross, Arkansas, Nick Rahal, West Virginia. So my question to you is, from what you're hearing on the ground or just your sort of intuition, is this Is the bleeding has the bleeding stopped, or are there going to be a spate of Democrat retirements over the next year?
I think it's sort of hard to say. I think we'll definitely see a few more retirements, but I think that blog post is kind of misleading because, I mean, you can list off any 10 incumbents who might be in tough districts and wonder if they're retiring and sort of raise, concerns about them. As you're getting at here, and as Gary is getting at, it's always a sign when there's a lot of retirements that there's going to be a big change in the makeup of the House the next year. In 2006 and 2008, there were both 20-something Republican incumbents who retired, and now I think it's probably about 12 or 14 Democrats are retiring this year. And interestingly, a good 12 or 14 Republicans are retiring as well, although many of them are actually leaving their seats to go look for higher office. Which certainly suggests that things are looking better for Republicans. But it is opening stuff up for Democrats too, because you have, for instance, that Mike Castle seat in Delaware, where a Democrat has a good chance to pick that up. But yeah, I think it's definitely something people on both sides of the aisle are watching. Ironically, I wouldn't be as concerned about a lot of the names that Garrity listed, because a lot of those people are sort of longtime blue dog Democrats who have been in those seats for a while. I would be more concerned about people who you wouldn't think about retiring per se. But the seats that are actually in danger are going to be the freshman and sophomore
Do you have any
seats.
names you want to throw out there of potential people if we start to see them retiring, then it's
Not if you
a
start to see them retiring. I just think the weaknesses in the Democratic caucus, like I think in 2006 and 2008, the weaknesses for Republicans were definitely their older incumbents who were getting out of touch with their districts, who hadn't had a tough campaign in a while. And I think it's sort of reversed, where the weaknesses for the Democrats aren't sort of their old bulls, but it's the freshmen and sophomores who sort of made the gains and are sort of tenuous right now. So I don't know if retirements will play as big a role as they have in the past, but you saw it in 94 when a ton of Democrats retired, and if it keeps going and becomes more of a trend, if it breaks into the 20s, then that's going to be a serious issue for the House Democrats, I think.
We'll keep an eye on it to see whether this is a harbinger of things to come or not. So that's the Democrats' problem. Republicans have some problems as well in terms of internecine struggles. And sort of the latest seems to be, and Hotline's been covering, National Journal's Hotline's been covering this pretty well, but this sort of issue with the National Republican Senatorial Committee. As you may recall, they really came under sharp criticism earlier this year when they endorsed Charlie Crist immediately upon entering the race. And then, we had the House race, New York 23, with Dede Scozzafava. Apparently, that sent a signal that the Republican establishment maybe should stay out of ordaining, endorsing candidates in primaries. And so then the NRSC seemed to back off. They seemed to say, we've endorsed Crist, but we're not going to really get involved anymore. We're not going to give any money. But the latest is that, Red State has uncovered the fact that, this Senate race, the attempt to oust Barbara Boxer in California, Carly Fiorina, who's running against Assemblyman Chuck DeVore. You know, Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, running against Chuck DeVore. And the NRSC has have not endorsed her officially, but there have been all along speculation that they're sort of covertly helping her campaign. And the latest is that they have a joint fundraising operation with her. And so Quinn Hilliard, American Spectator, wrote, you know, says in response to Red State's post criticizing him for taking nasty shots at Chuck DeVore's Senate campaign in California, something no staffer should do. The NRSC's Brian Walsh again attacks the DeVore campaign. And here's a quote from Brian Walsh of the NRSC. It's hard to draw any conclusion other than that this is a campaign that likes to play games. NRSC spokesman Brian Walsh said, it's unfortunate, but if and when they'd like to stop this nonsense and work with us on defeating Barbara Boxer next year, we look forward to meeting with them. And Hilliard goes on to say, this is an outrage. No campaign committee staffer should be publicly disparaging a campaign that may end up being that of its party's nominee for a key Senate seat. So what is your take on that? I mean, is there any comparison on the Democrat side right now? And generally, I mean, is the NRSC being smart by picking winners and losers? Are they making a mistake of sort of dipping their toe in halfway? What say you?
Well, I would say in general, it behooves any party committee to walk very delicately around a local primary, whether it's state level or in a congressional district. I think on the whole, it's better to let the grassroots play out and you know, have a candidate who's got real power behind them from the base. But, I mean, there are times when some subtle, indications of support from the top may help. And what I'm thinking of actually is, if you remember, in a Senate special election in 2006, not a special election, when Paul Hackett, a erstwhile Democratic star who failed to win a House seat in Ohio, was going to run for Senate there, and the party sort of pushed him out in favor of Sherrod Brown, who's the current senator who won his race. And there was some bad blood there between the Netroots, who really like Hackett, and and the DSCC. But I think at the end of the day, that wasn't a big a deal because Sherrod Brown is a really progressive guy, whereas in this case, Carly Fiorina and Chuck DeVore are a little further apart on who's the more conservative person. I haven't seen the polling from that race, so I don't know how much of a threat DeVore is to Fiorina. But right. To be
right
honest,
right now it's neck and neck. Actually,
it's
both
neck
of
and
them
neck.
Trail. Both of them trail Boxer by about 10 points, and I think the last poll I saw, Fiorina was up by I think 1 point over DeVore. So it's close. But the question will be, can DeVore raise enough money to challenge? And Fiorina could write a check probably. And by the way, these committees love self-funders. That's the other thing. Patrick Ruffini wrote a great piece at The Next Right sort of bashing self-funders. And I think as conservatives, I mean, I can tell you, I don't have a philosophical problem with people who can write their own checks. It just so happens they usually end up not being great candidates for whatever.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think that's definitely a mistake that a lot of party committees make, is they look for the people with the money who don't quite have the message. But I just wonder if Chuck DeVore, I wonder if, you know, they're looking at the state of California as a whole and wondering if someone as conservative as DeVore can win there. Because as much as it is something that, you know, activists on either side hate to hear, you know, I think there are places where you have to strike for the middle if you want to win. And when you look at Republicans who win statewide in California, Arnold Schwarzenegger being the current example, not that his tenure has been super successful, but that's not so much him as the state of California. You know, I think you need to look at what kind of candidate best represents your party there, and I'm not sure if DeVore really is the guy for that, and I wonder if people in Washington or even other state party leaders, I don't know if the state party's gotten involved, have sort of concerns about him being able to be a real effective general campaign candidate against Boxer. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, and I think part of the problem may be the way the NRSC is doing it. And first of all, I think it's clearly inappropriate for a staffer to.
Yeah, that just looks bad. That just looks bad, that quote. I mean, that's, like I said, you should tread carefully. If these party committees want to mess around in there, they really shouldn't do it in such a way that it looks like they're going after the grassroots activists, because that's just going to hurt them down the way.
Definitely. And again, you know, Red State and American Spectator are sounding the alarm. So But all this stuff is, at this point, tangential, if that's the right word. It is not the focus this week. Obviously, healthcare is
the
focus.
We got healthcare.
Yeah, you want to go ahead and get us started with that?
Well, I think the biggest thing that happened in healthcare this week has sort of been the backlash to the death, as we're saying right now, of the public option. And I'm personally hoping that that's not, in fact, the case. But it doesn't look like it's in the cards to see a public option, in at least the Senate version of the healthcare bill. And it's really been met with a big backlash among the netroots, particularly Fire Dog Lake, Daily Coast, Howard Dean. All of these people have come out and said, look, this is not a bill worth supporting. We should kill it. And that has sparked a sort of a real argument between sort of the policy wonks on the left, people like Ezra Klein and John Cone, I guess myself, if I had to include myself, Matt Iglesias, Kevin Drum, versus some of the people who are more from the netroots, going back and forth about whether or not the Senate healthcare bill is worth supporting. People on the further left, or people from the netroots, the activist people, are making the argument that, look, this is a giveaway to insurance companies without the public option or a Medicare expansion that's going to throw some competition into the mix and make it so we're not just giving insurance companies a real steady customer base. But others in the Iglesias, Klein, Drum, Cone community are saying, look, you know what, this is actually a real step in the right direction. It's going to be the biggest progressive piece of legislation since the Great Society. Yes, it is going to give the insurance companies more business because of this individual mandate, but the new regulations and the subsidies are going to make it more affordable for people. It's going to make it so people aren't getting kicked out their health care for pre-existing conditions. People aren't going to be going bankrupt because of medical problems they didn't foresee. And so, you know, it's a real question of what people in the president's coalition are willing to accept, and it's a real tough argument. And, you know, I think part of the problem has been the Obama administration has just not fought very hard for some of these priorities of people on the left. And, you know, I think the policy wonks as well agreed that the public option or the Medicare expansion would have been a good idea. But the Obama administration really didn't fight for it. So it's going to be
interesting. You know, I think that potentially, if you remember when Harry, you know, the Baucus bill came out of committee, out of the Senate Finance Committee, and I thought we were ready to go with that. They had Olympia Snow lined up, and then Harry Reid, out of nowhere, presumably talked about the opt-out version. I think that was an example of Harry Reid showing that he was going to fight for some form of a public option, albeit not a robust public option, so that when he couldn't get it, people would know, well, hey, I at least fought for it. But if you contrast that to Obama, I don't think people feel like he has fought for it, liberals. And does that sound right to you?
I think that's definitely right. I mean, look, if you look in the big healthcare speech to Congress earlier this year, he talked extensively about a public option, but never sort of drew a line on it. You know, you never saw a real consolidated whipping effort. You never saw people making calls. You never saw sort of the heavy pressure that a president can put on a member of Congress to do it. Now, look, I want to make clear, though, that, you know, the president can't legislate. And as much as I would like to have President Obama come in and save the day and write this bill and make it look like I want it to look, he doesn't have every tool in his toolbox to be able to do that. And I think if it wasn't Joe Lieberman, it would have been Ben Nelson, or it would have been one of these other senators who would have probably shut down the public option in it. I have not thought the votes were there in the Senate for a long time, but I think he would have kept his coalition together had he shown more effort on that front.
You mentioned Lieberman, because Ezra Klein said something this week in the Washington Post. And by the way, I'm of the opinion Ezra Klein is great. I just think they should have a conservative at the Washington Post as well. I think it's absurd that they have someone who is, you know, clearly not non-ideological. I mean, he used to speak at the Netroots Nations writing for them, and they do not have somebody on staff as a conservative. So let me just get that in
there. George Will doesn't work there anymore?
Well, first of all, Ezra
Charlie
Klein Krauthammer? Is a...
The, no, I see your point. They don't have a resident conservative wonk.
Right,
I think they could use it.
Columnists. I don't think they work at the Washington Post as staffers. And they're certainly not bloggers. I mean, they're columnists, and I think they're syndicated nationally. And the Washington Post is probably the biggest outlet that they use. I mean, there's Kathleen Parker, too. There's Michael Gerson. I mean, so, yeah, they have some conservative voices there. But if you look at the people who actually work there, like Ezra, and who's a blogger, I don't think there is parody.
I don't know. I don't think so. I think probably they feel a little bit burned by Ben Dominic and that whole affair. But yeah, I don't think it could hurt for them to hire a conservative blogger who does what Ezra does. But unfortunately, there aren't a lot of conservative bloggers who do what Ezra does, which is learn a lot about the issues and then try and explain them as simply as he can. I don't think there's anyone out there sort of competing with him doing that on the right.
Well, if they were looking, well, first of all, they don't necessarily have to find a policy wonk. It could be a different sort of blogger. And I know that Ramesh Panuru does something there sometimes. It's I think it's more or less he throws a question out to the audience and it generates a debate. Ramesh from National Review, I don't think he blogs there. But look, I mean, I think that if they were going to get a conservative, they would probably have to go to like the Heritage Foundation or a think tank and get someone who has not been, you know, known as a blogger, but someone who is more of a policy expert. And they're out there. It's not as if they don't exist. But anyway, what Ezra Klein said about Joe Lieberman is his Lieberman's quote, seems willing to cause the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in order to settle an old electoral score. That to me seemed extremely harsh in questioning his motives and saying also the death of hundreds of thousands of people. And he did get some pushback from fellow Washington Post bloggers, but I thought that was beyond the pale, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more backlash or outrage over that comment.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's hard when you look at the moral consequences of the things you do, and I think a lot of the times you really have to look at, in the case of Lieberman in particular, what he's actually been saying. This is not someone who is sort of disagreeing about, you know, whether or not we need to provide insurance coverage, which is proven to prevent death to people. This is someone who's opposing it, something he literally endorsed on video a few months before in the case of the Medicare expansion, and has just been walking himself in circles trying to explain why all of a sudden he opposes something he supported a few months ago. Because why? Because of bans that he also. I mean, it's nonsense.
So you
I mean,
agree with Ezra Klein that Lieberman seems willing to cause the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in order to settle an old electoral score?
I would say that Lieberman is willing to sell out healthcare reform because of an old electoral score. I've watched him talk about this healthcare bill. And I will also say that I call his office maybe once a week to try and talk to his people about it, and he has never said a single accurate thing about why he opposes the things he opposes, and he changes his minds and flip-flops about it day to day. Someone like Ben Nelson, at least, opposes the public option, sort of always has, and hasn't mm-hmm. messed around with it, you know?
Well, the funny thing about Lieberman,
supported the public option when he ran for president. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous the way he's taking a stand. And frankly, yeah, opposing healthcare reform is going to have consequences. If this reform doesn't pass, we're not going to have healthcare reform for a long time. If you look at the history of what's happened, the last time we had a chance at healthcare reform was, what, 15 years ago? So it's going to be 15 more years of, you know, millions of people not covered by insurance. And yeah, that's going to have results. People are going to die.
Okay.
And it's sad.
Let me just drill down on that, though. Because
yeah,
I think this is important because you and I philosophically disagree over healthcare reform. I mean, I could ratchet up the rhetoric, and I could say that, some Democrats' support of healthcare reform means that grandma's going to be denied care and go before a death panel. And, you know, Sarah Palin essentially said the right-wing version of what Ezra Klein has said, but she was...
I think that's a pretty false analogy, because the thing is that the death panels were never there. Those were assisted ways for doctors to talk about end-of-life care, and, you know, there was never any question that people would be denied care because of those discussions. Whereas, if there's no health insurance reform, people are not going to get the care they need. That's a fact.
Look, I think number one, I could make just as good of an argument that Palin's right as you could that Klein's right. But putting that aside, because we're not going to agree on that, my point is that the rhetoric, my point is that this is a guy who writes for the Washington Post, and to say that Lieberman seems willing to cause the death of hundreds of thousands of people might be fine at Fire Dog Lake, might be fine at the Daily Kos. But is that really the type of rhetoric that the Washington Post wants. I just find
I don't know what the Washington Post wants, but I'll tell you what I want. And what I want is some real talk. The stuff that happens in the Senate floor has consequences for Americans across the country. It has real consequences in the case of health care reform about whether or not people are going to get their checkups, whether or not kids are going to get their shots, whether or not old folks are going to be able to go back to the doctor for that follow-up appointment and maybe catch something they missed the first time.
I happen to think that more people will be healthier and that will have freedom and that people won't die if we allow the American system to work. We vastly disagree on that, but that's not my point because I'm not going to convince you, you're not going to convince me. I just think that the rhetoric that he used is extremely harsh and inappropriate for the Washington Post, but that's up to them to decide. So a conservative angle on this has to do with red state. As you know, yesterday, I mean, we're taping this on – what is today? Is today Thursday?
Today is Thursday.
So on Wednesday, Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma takes to the floor – and he decides to insist that the clerk of the court actually read the entire Bernie Sanders amendment, which would have taken potentially days to do, as a procedural sort of stalling. Some people will call it a stunt. And that's, you know, I think conservatives thought that was great. Liberals thought it was horrible. But the interesting thing to note is that days earlier on December 12th, I think that was Saturday, Eric Erickson at Red State wrote the following. I'm going to read it to you. It's a little bit long, but I think it's important. The Senate, unlike the House – this is Eric. The Senate, unlike the House of Representatives, has parliamentary rules and procedures that give the minority the ability to stall legislation. In fact, unlike the House, the minority have the ability to virtually paralyze the Senate. Doing so is not something we would want or expect for every bad bill that comes through Congress, but the proposed health care legislation – is probably the worst piece of legislation ever considered by the United States Congress. It is the most intrusive, most damaging, most costly, most dangerous bill to the economic and personal freedom and liberty of individual Americans that Congress has ever considered. If there is any bill that deserves being stopped by shutting down the Senate, it is this one. There are a whole series of parliamentary maneuvers that could be used by Republicans to stop this bill. There is a hard backstop to the current process Christmas. The Republicans' goal should be to prevent Reid from passing the bill before that time. If he goes past Christmas and is forced to adjourn or recess, the momentum will shift in favor of those opposing the bill. How could this be done? To start with, they should stop constantly agreeing to unanimous consent.
Well, I think we get the idea, man. I mean, people can click on the link.
Thank you. Thanks for informing me of how this show works, because I obviously hear each and every week. My point is... Let me ask you your opinion of this, since you're obviously an expert. Did the Republicans take their cues from a blogger? And I'll let you talk.
Well, I will say a couple things. One is, it's certainly possible. I mean, I don't know. I know Red State is obviously a very popular blog on the right. I assume Republicans in Congress read it, and I'm sure they take it seriously because I know that there's a lot of people behind it. But I think if you look a few weeks back, Judd Gregg actually released a letter outlining a series of procedural maneuvers that he wanted his colleagues to be aware of so that they could do exactly what Eric is talking about, which is to try and obstruct this bill and prevent it from going through Congress. But what I think, more broadly, I guess, in our democracy, I wonder if it is, in fact, the best thing to be doing to be using these procedural tactics to obstruct this bill, or any bill for that matter, instead of just having an up or down vote on it. And I know that's certainly a controversial thing given the filibuster battles back in 2005, but I think, I am certainly coming down on the side that we should not have so many obstructions in our, policy-making system, so many veto points. And I weigh, of course, the charges of hypocrisy because of the cheerful use that the Democrats made of the filibuster and other such maneuvers during their time, but I am willing to concede that was a bad idea, and that we ought to look forward
very
to some kind
of... Very convenient
of
you to concede that now.
Sorry?
Very convenient of you to concede that now.
Oh, yeah. So here's what I'm willing to support to prove my good faith on this, is we need to get into kind of a Rawlsian situation here, and there was a good article in the New Republic about this, but basically saying Republicans and Democrats should agree that so many election cycles from now, when it's sort of unclear who's going to be in charge, you filibuster will be eliminated and do it that way. But... going on, I just want to say on that post that Eric has written and so nobly suggested that, you know, this bill needs to be stopped at all costs. Do you really think that this bill will remove our republic? Because the first sentence of his thing is that 60 senators are poised to destroy our republic. Not destroy, I want to get this right. Poised to, take away our republic. I don't think that's even remotely true. I think if this bill gets passed, even if the most liberal version of it got passed, we would wake up the next day in pretty much the same United States of America, only some more people would have health care and insurance companies would make less money. I think it is, as we're talking about rhetoric, sort of ridiculous to say that this is going to take away our republic and destroy freedom.
Well, first of all, let me say that the Washington Post has not given their imprimatur to Eric Erickson, and sadly he is not on the pages of the Washington Post or online there, and so this is red state.
I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think the Washington Post is a very good newspaper in general, so I don't know that we want to use that as sort of our bar of what's good and right. Let's just call them as we see them.
Well, my point is I think red state is the daily coast of the right. I mean, they're an activist blog, and I would expect them to have maybe more intense rhetoric. I think that it is very true to say that if healthcare passes, we will be essentially socializing a sixth of the U.S. economy, and I think that our freedoms our freedoms will begin to slowly erode, which is probably different than what he wrote. So I will grant you, I don't think I will wake up. And
I will just note this, that's what Ronald Reagan said about Medicare in the 60s, and I still feel pretty free now that I know that the elderly have socialized health care.
Well, there you've done it again. there you go again, as Reagan would say. Okay, so...
Do you think that the Republicans in the Senate took Eric's words to heart here? Do you think they're reacting to what they're hearing among the activist base?
I talked to some Senate aides. They, not surprising, completely deny it. In fact, they tell me the fact that I asked that question is absurd. But look, there were amendments that passed before, and Republicans didn't have any stalling mechanisms or didn't attempt to slow things down. So it does strike me as interesting that they conveniently decided to actually fight back, you know, using parliamentary rules a couple days after Erickson writes this post. Now, I'm told that it wasn't just Coburn, that this was a part of a larger strategy, that Mitch McConnell had been in on it, and that that this was sort of part of the plan all along. Maybe that's so.
There was that letter from Jed Gregg, and I don't want to take anything away from Eric, because I don't think, you know, Republicans
and by the way,
do
Eric's
it
not unless pushing
they sound
this.
Like they, but they've definitely been thinking about it. I'm sorry?
Sorry to interrupt you, Eric. It's not like Eric is pushing this. I mean, I'm the one asking this question, Eric. And, you know, you're not saying it, but I don't want anybody to think that Eric is claiming credit for this because he's not. I'm the one who sort of found it just interesting. But the odds are it's a coincidence that great minds think alike. So.
Well, you know, I think it's like any other situation where you have people in a party, you know, you've got to push your representatives to show some backbone on the issues that matter. And obviously, if Republican senators are getting the sense, as I think they probably are, as they're supposed to demonstrate,
right,
that they want, that their constituents wants them to hold up health care, they're going to be more likely to do it.
And maybe this, and it's also possible that this is an idea that they had, and Eric helped push them over, you know, it was a... Should we do it or not, you know? So who knows? But it is interesting, and it will be interesting to see if it continues, because what happened is Sanders, the socialist who caucuses with Democrats, he decided to withdraw his amendment, which apparently broke the rules according to, I guess, Rule 15, paragraph 1 of Riddick's Senate procedure. Unanimous consent is required to dispense reading such an amendment. That does the Republicans little good, to be technically right. It happened. After about, I guess, 2 or 3 hours, Sanders rescinded the amendment, and so the debate went on. But we'll see what happens, and don't be, you know, I think Coburn has promised more of these hijinks to come. So we'll see. And again, there could be backlash to this, like when the Republicans shut down government, you know, in the 90s. If Democrats squash it, that looks bad too.
It's very hard to tell how these procedural gambits are going to play out in the public eye. I think on the whole, most people don't really care what you know, how process works out in the Senate and the House. I think they care mostly about the results. And that's, I think, why the government shutdown was such a thing, because people could see what happened when those process shenanigans went too far. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how both parties play this. One last thing I wanted to bring up, anything else on the procedural obstructionism of our friends in the Senate?
The last thing I have is today the Note reported that Harry Reid said we will have a bill in the Senate by Christmas, so... That will depend on how much of these shenanigans go on. So,
well, indeed. Well, I just wanted to mention, given your concerns about this healthcare bill being pretty bad for us and our freedom, that you have a friend, and you have a friend in Governor Howard Dean, who wrote today in the Washington Post, our favorite newspaper apparently, that progressives ought to be trying to kill this bill because it doesn't have the public option, and he too has been met with a lot of backlash from people in the blogs saying that even his healthcare plan in 2003, when he ran for president, was worse than the reforms, worse from the left point of view than the reforms currently in the Senate now. And I just wanted to ask, how do you feel siding with Howard Dean?
You know, it's interesting. I really feel like Howard Dean, he and I are complete opposites politically. I mean, we're agreeing on this. We both want to kill the bill, but for completely different reasons, and we're very different politically, and that goes without saying. But I truly have a lot of respect for Howard Dean. I really do. Even though I disagree with him, I feel like he's the guy you want on your side fighting with you. He's not going to cave in. He's not going to go along to get along. He's not going to try to cut a deal. I think he's a true believer. I think he stands on principle. And I think he didn't get credit for all the good work he did as chairman of the DNC. You know, there's clearly a schism between him and the Obama administration and some of the people there. But he did a great job at the DNC. You know, I think that you could just look at the results and say that. And I admire him for his toughness and his tenacity, even though we disagree. I find myself kind of admiring him for his toughness.
Yeah, I don't think anyone questions his toughness, just his political judgment. And I think you're absolutely right that he did not receive the credit he deserved for the work he did as the chairman of the DNC. But I do think that he is off on this call. And I think it's because he sees his role as sort of the guy outside of government to try and push these issues and try and make sure that the bill gets as far left as it can. He can afford to do that, not sitting in elected office. But I think the worry is when you start listening to too many people who don't have to go before the voters and sort of make their case that way, that you end up with some policy decisions that aren't, you know, quite so real world. So it's going to be interesting. Yeah. But I do think it's funny to look back at how far we've come since Howard Dean's original proposal for healthcare reform back in 2003, because it really is shades away from even the weakest thing we're thinking about passing right now. I mean, it didn't even get to universal healthcare. So it's going to be interesting to see how this turns out and where Howard Dean comes down at the end of the day, and also what they do in the House with this bill.
Well, I think a couple of things are interesting from that. Number one, anybody who opposes this, clearly there are people who will dig into their past and try to find an example of hypocrisy. Whether it's Lieberman on the right or Dean on the left, if you say something bad about this bill, they will dig up something about you and try to say that you're changing your tune on it. So clearly,
are you surprised? Don't we do that with everything? Isn't that what we do?
It just seems like people are ratcheting it up on this one, but maybe it's just me. The other thing I will say is you might be right, and there's always a tension between the people who actually have to get things done versus the kind of utopian ideologues. I mean, we see it on the right with the people like the American Life League who think the national right to life are a bunch of sellouts, or Gun Owners of America who thinks the national right to life is a bunch of sellouts. And there's a tension there between the people who sort of have the freedom to not have to pass bills. And sometimes they're right and sometimes the other side's right. But look, I think Democrats are in danger of doing what Republicans did. Republicans passed, you know, Medicare Part D. They passed No Child Left Behind. They did it because Bush had to pass something, because Bush begged them and said it would be a disaster and it would ruin his administration if they didn't pass it. And so we had conservatives, many of whom put their reputations on the line to vote for something that they really didn't believe in, that they really didn't like. And I think maybe there's a danger that this is happening to Democrats, to liberals, actually. That in order to save Obama's hide, some of them are voting for bills that aren't really good, that they don't really believe in. And maybe it's going to work out the way it worked out for Republicans.
It will be interesting to see that. But I will say, at the very least, if the health care reform bill, with its deficit-lowering ways, is the biggest folly that Obama is going to pass and have liberals vote for, it can't be that bad, because at least we won't sink the budget with it. But yeah, you know, I think there's also been comparisons of late, which has been really interesting on the left. There was a blog post at Daily Kos saying, look, the divide in the net roots among people on the healthcare bill is people who supported the Iraq war, grudgingly, are saying, you know, vote for the Senate healthcare bill, and people who didn't on the activist side are saying, no, kill it. Now, that doesn't really line up, in fact, because there are people who are anti-war who support this bill, Barack Obama being one of them, another one being Paul Krugman, who wrote a pretty eloquent blog post about why liberals should support the Senate healthcare bill. You know, I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, it's making the sausages hard. You know, governing is hard. And the Democrats need to prove that they can actually pass a policy that's a real reform and changes things and hold their coalition together. And,
well, I think the most true thing either of us said today is what you just said, is that making sausage is hard. I agree. And I think that I don't know that you can pass anything really big without there being a backlash. And some of that backlash might be Blanche Lincoln losing her seat, you know, if this happens. So it's tough. It's a tough business. And, you know, I think our founding fathers, in their infinite wisdom, created a system of checks and balances. Frankly, and I think some of this didn't come from the founding fathers, but some of it's sort of Senate tradition as well. But in any regard, we do have a system where it's very tough to change things and to do anything, and things happen slowly, and generally I think that has served us well.
Well, you know, we have managed to survive as a nation in a republic for this long, but I gotta tell you, I think if you look in the last two decades, the way the filibuster has increased in use, I don't think the founding fathers intended that. It's gone from being a emergency measure to a permanent requirement for a supermajority. And given the problems that our country faces and the need to do a lot of serious work on things, not just healthcare reform, but also energy bill, also the budget, the deficit. I know you want to talk about the national debt, which is a serious bummer. If we really want to do anything on that, I think we need to think about how the supermajority is making it hard for our institutions to deal with problems.
I believe it was George Washington who said that the Senate is like the saucer which cools the coffee before you drink it.
So. Well, unfortunately, I think it's become the freezer that freezes the coffee before you drink it. We need to
All
turn
right,
it down.
Well, let's end it at that. Thank you for joining us again. Hey, do you want to plug your website, plug your Twitter feed, and what you're up to these days?
Well, check me out at the American Prospects website. Our blog is Tapped. I'm on Twitter at Tim Fernholz. And, you know, there'll be links on the right side. Check them all out. Matt, it's always a pleasure to be here with you on the Weekend Blog. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Tim. And everybody, check us out at Twitter.com/TheWeekendBlog and Facebook/TheWeekendBlog. For Tim Fernholz, I am Matt Lewis. And wherever you are, Bill Scher, have a martini for me, and we'll see you in the new year. Thanks,
Happy holidays, everybody. Take it easy, mate.
Thanks.